Jean. Welcome to this session on income for most of you who love to do, actually. So, my name is Petter, and I'm here this week talking about consumption. I think a bunch of you are from Our Saviors. I should probably introduce myself as Sam Bardwell's and Martha Schwain's brother-in-law. I might straighten some things out and confuse you in other ways. But I'm here to talk about consumption. And it's less of a talk, it's much more of a conversation. And I began last night by talking a little bit about consumption being why we're at Holden. First off, the mine. The mine was built to satisfy our desires to have things. Pipes and warplanes and cars and wires and copper tubing. Lots of different things that were made from the mine here. But even now, we're consuming here. The food we had has to be trucked in for the most part. All of you had to get here on boats and trains and had to consume things to get here. And as a consequence, one presupposition that I'm framing this today and this week is that we are consumers. We will always consume things. We have needs, shelter, food, water, relationships, all those things. We will always consume. That's just a, sort of a fact of life. And the way I wanted to begin today in terms of thinking about income is to start here. And I'm trying to tie it into the theme of the Bible study that Mary Emily is leading in on at 9 a.m. in the morning. And she's looking at John, and she's focusing on one part of John, but I'm more broadly speaking with John. But I thought we'd start here, because this, in a lot of ways, is the frame I want us to think about income through. So this is John 10:10, and in it Jesus says, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." And I'd like to ask you, what do you think abundance here means?
Clean air.
Clean air. So natural world is abundant with health hygiene, to tie it into Martin's session, and cleanliness, and things that don't make us sick. Other thoughts?
I would say a life full of love.
Okay. So, could I ask you a little further? I mean, love what? Or how love?
I think it's understanding your life with God and that love abundantly so that you can fully take in that love and understand it.
Okay.
But then also, I think love with friends and family.
Okay, so it's relational.
Yeah.
I mean, to love in a lot of ways is to have some object upon which you relate lovingly. So I think that's quite smart. Yes, it's about relationships. And in a lot of ways, what God wants of us is to be in relationship both with God and with each other. And in many ways, it's that relationship that makes us who we are. Makes us Christians. I think I'd argue that it's very difficult to be a Christian by yourself because God wants you to be in relationship with each other. Other thoughts? Even more broadly than just abundant, if anyone has thoughts about this. Absolutely, very complicated, and it raises questions about what Christ is, and I actually encourage you to go to Mary Emily's session either on Thursday or Friday, where she's actually looking at John's Christology, because that's a Christological question, which is a great question. It's really not uber important for us today in some ways, but it is important to recognize that where does abundance really come from? Does it come from things in the world? It comes from God in Christ. In a lot of ways, we have this world that we exist in, and it's full of relationships, and many of those relationships are distorted by sin, they're broken, they're confusing. But sometimes we try to fill the brokenness by buying things and hoping that that will fill the sort of restlessness of our hearts. But ultimately, true abundance doesn't come from anything we do. It comes from Jesus, God descending to be with us, God with us, Emmanuel, those kinds of images of Christ. And the Lutheran tradition in particular sort of relishes that view of Jesus, because what does it do? It frees us. I mean, we ended yesterday in a lot of ways sort of in a situation of hopelessness. No decision we make is a good decision. I mean, there's better decisions and there's worse decisions, but all decisions are sort of fraught. But in a lot of ways, what the Lutheran tradition in particular, but other forms of Christianity say, that's okay. Because true abundance is an act of God. It's not something we can do. It's not something we can work to bring about. We're obligated in a lot of ways, in terms of the pattern of our life, to try and be responsible and intentional about our actions, to try and live out this abundance. But there is a freedom that comes through this idea of what Christ has done, God has done in Christ. And so when we think about abundance, I think it's good. It's relational. It asks us to be in relationship with each other. It asks us to care about each other. I mean, underneath here, you also have ideas, obviously, that's throughout the Hebrew Bible, but it's also clearly in the New Testament, that love your neighbor as yourself. That this relationality is vital to understand how I am, because we are. Those kinds of attitudes are important. And again, that it comes from Jesus, and in a lot of ways, that's free. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try and live abundantly. Just really changes how we live abundantly. And so with that, I want to ask this question. And what I want you to do is I'd like you to turn to your neighbor, and I'd like you to try and find someone you don't know. So if that means you got to move, I'd like you to move. And I want you to share how much you earn in a year. And an average is, it's kind of an odd place to say it. I look at Lori and Scott here, and you know, they're volunteers here. And I don't see a lot of actually holding volunteers here. But I'd like you to share how much you earn with this person you do not.
Your household or you?
Either way.
Well,
income.
I think that's an important question.
Yeah. Okay, household income.
Household.
Household income. I'm being very general.
Is my total income return on investment?
Sure. I think wages is fine. I mean, it doesn't. I'm not going to be that specific. This is sort of just general. I'm trying to make a soccer with it because I don't think we like to talk. Have we all admitted something yet? No. No. Hey, that's what I wanted. How we doing? How we doing? Can we talk a little bit? Let me, before I ask further questions, how many people were comfortable with this question?
I don't know, or so
whatever. This is what I was expecting, so I'm glad it was
why are we so uncomfortable talking about how much we make each year? Or our household income, whether it's wages or return on investments or things. Why are we so uncomfortable?
It's a very private thing.
But why is it private?
Because we're afraid it's either too much or too
yeah.
little.
Why are we afraid it's too much or too little?
Because we're comparing ourselves to
others. Okay.
That's how our parents, that's how my parents raised me. I mean, I was never supposed to, I have no idea what my parents made. They would never tell us. So
oh, really?
They could never, as children, tell other parents.
But why is that? Is it because of kind of anxiousness about comparisons to others? I mean, I share the same thing in my
yeah.
growing up, but
yeah.
how do we get there?
Our personal worth is reflected mm-hmm. somehow in whether we make enough or...
Part of it, absolutely right. I think in many ways, many of us associate how much you make with how valuable you are in society. I think that's one dimension. I think there's lots more, and I'm hoping we can spend some time with it. Yeah.
I would say there's a lot of fear with it.
Why?
My parents only started talking about it more recently. And my dad remembers his parents were farmers and very, very poor. And he remembers they never talked about how much they made or money. And he remembers finding his dad crying behind the barn, worried
wow.
about money.
Of course, that's coming out of a place of poverty equaling shame. I mean, again, that still is that rubric of word that income, they all mingle together. So, you know,
I wonder if it starts to open up the possibility that, well, if I start talking about it, then maybe other people will start saying, you should do this or you should do that,
mm-hmm.
or you know, that this now invites other people to be part of the decision of what happens.
And in some ways, that could come across as you're irresponsible. Let me help you because you've been irresponsible. You're not doing all you should. So.
Yeah, I think
also.
To dovetail off the viewers, I think there's the secrecy allows some manipulation from the corporate heads because if we're all quiet about it, then we don't know that 1% of
mm-hmm. sure,
money
absolutely.
So much
right.
more money.
Yeah.
And if I don't talk to you, then maybe you'll think I, or I'll think you, or, you know, any number of other things.
Absolutely.
Are. Yeah, and, you know, in any in working environment, we can perhaps relate to that. I worked in a school, and when I learned that I made more money than the teachers in that school, who worked so hard, you know, and everyone was kept secret,
mm-hmm.
because then they would resent,
mm-hmm.
you know, they knew a month before I did that they made less.
I mean, I'm hearing shame and worth and value, and yet making a wage is so much a part of our identity and culture, too. Because guess what happens in terms of how much you make? It relates to class, which is, I think, even more so. I'm surprised no one brought that up. I mean, Americans, you go to Europe, they talk about class all the time. And in fact, you're sort of identified with the class. And we don't, everyone... I think there's all these statistics to talk about. Most Americans identify as middle class. And middle class stretching from something like $250,000 a year to something like $25,000 a year. Which, come on, $250,000 versus $25,000, I mean, the amount you can purchase and the lifestyle you live and how conspicuous you are, I mean, there's a huge variance in that. Other thoughts or anything that comes to mind?
Well, just on the point of class, similar to your memory, and I, my one memory of sharing some information as a kid with a neighbor kid friend was that I grew up in a, what I think was a fairly wealthy household, said that to a friend in the presence of my mom and was scolded because she said, you know, middle class. And that was kind of that stark story of that wide middle class definition.
Mm-hmm. So again, issues of identity. I mean, these are, I think that's partially why I wanted to talk about this tonight, but I think it's so crucial we talk. Because it's where faith and identity and our sense of worth and our societal value and how people perceive us all those sort of mesh together, I think, often when we think about income. And in terms of where we are as a context, I mean, obviously, we sort of, I started out with the abundant quote, but for the most part, we live in an economy of scarcity. There's only so many goods. There's only so many good jobs. There's only so many good cars. There's only so many good spots in a college.
Yeah.
And which obviously is based on this view of life as being sort of a competition. And we sort of couch it in various ways, I think, culturally in our discourse about the rat race or the chase or things like that. But often, I think underneath that is this idea of entitlement. And I think a lot of the political discourse, in particular this go-around because of the Occupy movement, that entitlement has come up quite a bit, which is sort of the main sort of thrust of what I want us to think about today. And the entitlement is that the wealthy have earned, they've labored for their status in society. That a CEO deserves what they make. A professional athlete deserves what they make. A teacher deserves what they make. Because they could have chosen another profession if nothing else. Yeah.
Well, and there's also the mythology that says, and you too can have
absolutely
as much as that if you work
absolutely
hard enough.
Absolutely. We'll talk a little bit about this. Part of me just wants to talk about where we are as a country. I mean, here the CEO pay was 185 times that of the average production worker in 2009. 65 was 24 times. Mm-hmm. Top 1% of Americans control nearly a quarter of all the country's income, the highest share controlled by the top 1% since 1928. And all this stuff comes from the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. There's a website. It's fantastic if you're interested in this at all. I mean, they have all the statistics. It's a whole center set up to study what poverty does, why poverty is, how it affects people, those kinds of things. And because of this great degree of income inequality, we have an attendant increase in childhood poverty, 21% of children. I think Marin's session this morning talked about 4% of, it had something to do with transfer, but 4% of children in Sweden were in poverty, 4%, America, 21%. Obviously, it relates to access to health care. If you're not healthy, when you get a good job, not necessarily, because you're going to be sicker. It's also true that I think for many of us, it's a rather uncertain time politically. I mean, someone this morning at Martin Session 2, city planner, and talking about certain spaces where they're designing it for health, actually. And someone said, oh, well, that makes sense because you're in Minnesota, but Minnesota's a mess right now. The Republicans control the House and the Senate and locked out. They locked themselves out last summer because they weren't going to sign anything that Dayton was going to, the Democratic governor was going to veto. I mean, so it's all over the place. Polarization, I think classism, though again, to me it's very interesting. We don't like to talk about class. Or when we do, we all want to be in the same broad definition of what a particular class is. I think to me it's kind of scary because it is secret. It's a lack of honesty. It's a lack of sort of willingness to recognize the vast income inequalities that exist in our culture. So it also leads to hopelessness. And to me, this is often the most frustrating part, is that there's a loss of a sense of what's common in our culture. And I think underneath it, and the way I want to enter into the conversation too with all of us, is to think about this belief. But I think in our economy, for the most part, one owns one's labor. Which underneath it implies a couple of things. It implies choice. That you have choice in terms of where you apply your labor. That if any of you wanted to, all of you right now, have a choice. Obviously you're at Holden Village. But you could have gone to work somewhere rather than come here for a vacation, study session, or hike fest, or chili fest, whatever you want to call them, tie dye fest, worship fest. All of you have that choice. There's also a connection between, obviously, income and labor. So there's this relationship that what I have is of value, and I'm going to figure out, because I'm going to make a choice about how best to apply my labor so that I'm rewarded in a particular way. And I think underneath that are sort of some concepts about responsibility. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You're responsible for your choice. You're responsible for your labor. You're responsible for your decisions. Make good decisions. That's why I am CEO of what's Magnus Pacific. Just use that. I don't know anything about them, so I'm not sure. Maybe he earns a dollar a day. But I'm sure you've heard of welfare queens. What are welfare queens? They don't want to work. No, they're in the dole. They don't want to work. They're not responsible. So how do we solve the issue of welfare queens?
Kick them off welfare.
Kick them off welfare. Because if they didn't have the dole, they might actually make some good decisions. Because, again, they're responsible for those things. And I think this is really pervasive, the self-made individual. I worked hard to get here. I always think of myself in this, not because I'm self-made, but because, you know, I went to St. Olaf my undergrad, and when I showed up at St. Olaf, let's just say I got in trouble a lot. Scott actually was a classmate of mine. I don't know if he could share any stories, but...
I won't hear it. We'll save it.
But, you know, St. Olaf was a safe place for a white, male, heterosexual man to screw up. They're not going to kick me out. But had I reversed the situation and say I've been in inner city high school and done some of the stuff I would have done, I probably would have ended up in jail. There's racism, there's called classism, it's called entitlement. I mean, this is a myth. I went to a public high school, I drive on public roads. A lot of things in the public healthcare industry are subsidized. I mean, this is the common that we tend to ignore it. And I got this quote from the TeaParty.net website: personal responsibility in free markets. Choice, responsibility. And one of the things that I wanted to do was sort of think about why we think this. And part of it is in our own mythology as a country. Someone read this?
Anyone? I'll read it.
Sure.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Most people familiar with this? Why might this be important in terms of thinking about entitlement? Choice and responsibility.
God said so.
Well, God said so, yeah. I mean, they're even more than that. I mean, they're obvious. Think about the weight of this word, self-evident. It's translucent. It's kind of clear. No, it's self-evident that it's, hey, all of us are equal, and all of us have the responsibility in some ways to pursue these things for ourselves. We have that right. I mean, it's the language of rights. It's the language of responsibility. And obviously this is a very important idea. I mean, in terms of forming the American mythos of what people are supposed to do and how they're supposed to live. It's very profound, and at the time, obviously, it was quite radical for what it was trying to say. And underneath this is a thinker named John Locke. And we're going to spend a little bit of time with him tonight, just because I think he's interesting, because he's so formative to how we understand politics in this country. A lot of his writing was influential with people like Thomas Jefferson when they drafted the Constitution. And in one of his books, he writes that the role of government is to defend life, liberty, and the state. Thomas Jefferson took it and said, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But for the most part, then we see this link between the thinking of John Locke and the founding of this country. So for, I don't know if there were any political scientists in college, but if you study American government, what do you study? Among other things, John Locke. So I think it, at least, I think it is interesting to say, okay, what did John Locke say? What are the, his sort of presuppositions and ideas that went into a statement like life, liberty, and escape, which then went into the American Declaration of Independence, which frankly has shaped some of the myths of how we live in this country and speak politically. So the first place I'm going to start is...
I just wanted to say something. It's interesting to then equate pursuit of happiness with escape, which is, I think, what we do. That's the unarticulated assumption
that
we have.
You have stuff, you're happy. I never thought about that. Yeah.
Didn't the first draft of the Declaration of Independence say of like liberty and pursuit of property?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think they changed it. So I want to start with the second treatise of government of John Locke. And this is a quote from his, and I'm wondering if anyone would like to read this for us. John.
The Bible gives us an account of those grants God made of the world to Adam and to Noah and his sons. It is very clear that God, as King David says in Psalm 115:16, has given the earth to the children of men, given it to mankind in common, by John Locke,
So, what does John Locke do in this type of statement here? First off, maybe I'll do it this way. What's this? Bible. What's the Bible?
God's Word.
It's a source of religious authority. It's a source to make some type of truth claim. The Bible says it must be true. So John Locke, one of the things he does here is he goes back to the Bible and says, what does God do? First off, I'm sorry.
This, given the earth to the children of men, these grants of God, these have been given to us as humans.
Yeah, and in here you can use as the word common.
And in common.
So, yeah, John. So common. God has given us this creation. So it's sort of step one. But then he moves this direction. I'll just read this. God, who has given the world to men in common, has also given them reason to make use of it to the best advantage of life and convenience. The earth and all that is therein is given to men for the support and comfort of their being.
Wow.
Mm.
Why don't we focus more on the in common part? Mm.
At least it didn't start with in the Bible.
That's true. That's true. But what's the point of this? What does this make you react? Obviously, some reactions. But what is Locke really doing here?
He's sort of suggesting that God has given us the earth so that we might consume.
Not only consume it,
best advantage for our convenience.
That was the U.S. government policy for taking land from the Native Americans.
Yes.
They weren't really.
We can use it better than anyone else.
So we'll just take it. And we'll use it better. We'll turn it into farms. We'll turn it into cities. Mm-hmm. It's not enough for the land to be there. The land has to be. And it continues to happen. Eminent domain.
Yeah. I mean, here's this connection. God has done something. Okay, that's pretty obvious here for us. But what does God really want us to do with it? God wants us to use what God gave us, thinking, human capacities to think and to argue and to reason and, frankly, to make things. And to do it so that we can live a life that is full of the best advantage, it's awkwardly said, I suppose, and convenience. We put lots of convenience stores. So we're starting to see sort of the building of an idea here, a conceptual frame to understand creation. And how do we build to the best advantage? The labor of his body and the work of his hands. we may say, are properly his. Whatsoever he removes out of the state that nature has provided and left it in, he has mixed his labor with and joined to it something that is his own and thereby makes it his property. This is all from the second treatise of
Domino.
I mean, he's a landed estate owner too. I mean, a very attractive one, actually.
I mean, the commonality might be about the upper class has in common. You know, it seems like there's an underlying assumption of what men equal white males of a high class.
White male property owners. Just like, I think the first draft of the Constitution, and I think it's actually true of a lot of people who originally to vote in this country, I think you had to be a white male who owned property. I mean, it wasn't universal suffrage, obviously not, even back then, because women couldn't vote. But here, guess what? Okay, what do people do? Here's God's creation. You've got to do something. You've got to make it about life and convenience and your best advantage. And how are you going to do that? With your labor. And, for John Locke, it is his, I suppose. And you've mixed it. So because you've mixed it, guess what? It's partially yours. It's partially yours. And not only that this is made by God this way. This isn't an accident. This isn't just something that we made up. Because it's the Bible. God gave us this. You know, he also uses Genesis. I mean, the idea of dominion to justify this.
But there's also the assumption that there's going to be enough for everyone. As long as people need it, there will be enough. And we will all be able to keep spreading out, and there it goes back to the manifest destiny that, like, well, when we need it, we'll find more.
Okay. That's a good point, yeah.
I think that's somewhere in there, too, that it will just always have enough space that we'll always be able to find more.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask about context, too, a little bit, like, but just wondering if, like, is he trying to differentiate between someone who would just sort of stake a claim somewhere without engaging with the land at all? And is this at some level trying to say, no, you have to be engaged with property that you want to own? I'm just wondering if this is in response to anything that could potentially be even worse. Do you know what I mean? Like, that maybe like at this time it was like a step forward to be like, no, like you shouldn't be involved with the land that you own and like get to do it and like
that's,
build that.
You're actually not that far.
And
you're actually not
like
that far from
say, all this is mine. I
right,
won't,
sure.
You know.
No, you're actually not that far. I mean, he comes from England. In England they had, you know, this is sort of post-feudal, and it's also true that this is the 16th and 17th century where monarchies and whatnot are starting to break down, and then it's the rise of the industrial economy that is great stress on the former traditional way of life. And you have all these estate owners who really don't do much with it. And so in some ways, he is trying to be sort of radical and say that here are these huge estates where these landed estate owners really don't do much with the property. Who does stuff with it? It's the renters or the former vassals of a particular area that are actually producing things. And he's worried about productivity. He's worried about economic development and progress. I mean, there's a deep sense of progress in a lot of this. I mean, we in the West, I don't think, realize it, how much our lens believes in the idea of progress, that things will get better. You know, if I just drive a better car and I wear better clothes and I have a faster computer, my life will be better. You know, I think that's sort of the foundational sort of myth of a lot of our thinking today.
This could be read also, it kind of dovetailing on this idea that we've been developing here about being a critique maybe of the idle nobility. This could be read as an anti-slavery position too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was ever used that way.
Well, I mean, partially this comes in. Really what he's doing too is he's trying to model a new government and what a government does. And what is a government really supposed to do? It's supposed to protect private property. Because if you don't have private property, how can you improve it to the best advantage of, for your life and convenience? I mean, arguably, again, this is something we talked about yesterday, but the view here is self-interest matters. You'll be self-interested to make things more convenient for you, and I think the optimistic view is enough of us get together, and we make a society that's much better than it was 50 years ago, because we're all self-interested. Today it's called rational choice theory, in terms of we're all rational creatures and we make good choices when we think reasonably, and consequently things will get better that way.
I think there's an irony here. I mean, John Locke was probably the aggressive going to prison for writing the things that he wrote at that time. And I'm sure he was no friend of the monarchy
right.
or the feudal or the nobility that existed at that time. And so Thomas Jefferson was also a radical, writing things
sure.
that were
Absolutely.
Radical thoughts at the time. Now,
sure.
here we are, 250 years later,
yeah.
living under the same model.
Sure.
And I think that's kind of ironic that we haven't moved on.
Yeah,
we're still stuck in
yeah.
the 1750s, 1780s.
Yeah, that's a good point. What I want to do then is sort of, okay, we have this founding myth in our country about income as entitlement, though. Because what is income? It's fruit of your own labor that you then have made a choice to sell at a particular price. With its roots in sort of Lockean political philosophy. And so I want to move to a sort of different idea. And go further back, and I thought it would be fun to also use a guy named Martin Luther's thought. And he places income within the idea of vocation. And this is one of his more radical sermons that you don't hear about very often. Partially because we don't use this word very often, and it takes a while to actually figure out how best to translate it because of these weird financial transactions that they had in 14th and 15th and 16th centuries. And what he says in this sermon is, first off, that when it comes to money and wealth and income, that the first thing he wants to tell his congregation is that fearing one doesn't make enough or have enough is a sign of a lack of faith in God. So he says, Scripture commands us not to put our trust and reliance in anyone but God alone. Step one, he wants to reframe thinking about wealth and income through a faith lens. And faith, obviously, is about trust. And it's putting your trust in one thing alone, God, and what God does. Some of the consequences, I think, are kind of interesting for us today. This also meant that there could be no insurance. And there were big debates amongst Lutheran communities in the 1800s over whether they should sell insurance to congregants, to lay members. Because what do you do in insurance? Someone else will guarantee you money if something bad happens to something you owe. And if you're having someone else guarantee that for you, what are you doing? Where's your faith? Prudential. Mass Mutual. I mean, I don't think we ever question that for the most part today. But there are huge debates, and some of the synods dropped out of certain Lutheran bodies because they thought you are not trusting in God if you buy insurance. So he then moves on, and he says, guess what? When I think about a wage I earn, if I think about my labor, I'm actually thinking relational. So he says this. So I'm going to read this one.
Determining how much profit you ought to take on your business and labor, there's no better way to reckon it than by computing the amount of time and labor you put into it and comparing that with the effort of a day labor. Works at some other occupation and seeing how much he earns in a day.
Going back to the CEO, 185 times the average production worker.
So is he suggesting that then you should give away the rest? Like you should keep for yourself whatever a day laborer would make and then?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, we have these systems of income, you know, we know what. And they didn't quite have the same system. I mean, I think it was a lot more you pick up work, or work is sort of randomly comes your way, so that you can never really be sure what you're going to make from day to day. We have, you know, checks and those sort of things. He doesn't have that, but if nothing else, what is he really doing? What's he really saying here?
They're equalizing work.
Your wages aren't yours, really. Your wages fit in this wider web of relationships. Your wages, then, in a lot of ways, can only be seen in relationship to other wages. It's not that I've earned this because this is what I've done, and so consequently I'm entitled to it. It's this whole web. You know, I think it's hard for us to get around it with sort of how different this vision of the world in some ways is. It's frankly, it's talking about how much you make. It's being honest and not secret about how much you make. Because you recognize that what you make is about relationships, both with God, with God and Jesus, but with each other. So it matters that you are paying attention. Because guess what? If you're going to compare it, you've got to know how much they make. I always think it's funny, too, in academia. Every year at a place like St. Olaf, they put up faculty salaries, and they compare them to their peer institutions. Because there's always grumbling. Oh, the people at Carleton, they make so much more money than we do. And they work less. I don't really think that's what Luther had in mind. John?
Do you think what he's saying here is that the only thing that is yours labor, and everything else is your gift? Your talent, your intellect, your position in life, those are all gifts, and you shouldn't reap benefit from gifts. You should only reap benefit from those things that are honestly yours, which is your time and effort.
I think that's a good way to put it. He doesn't use that in the sermon, but I certainly think that there's this gifted nature to everything we have. I mean, in some ways, he shares that with John Locke, that God has given us what we are and the creation that we can make things through and with and of. Otherwise, we wouldn't be. We are because God made us. And as a consequence, we only have labor to use because of this giftedness of God. And the reality is everyone's in the same boat. So I think I'm gonna
Obama quoted you on that last
Well, that one, yeah. So as relation, it then falls under the pattern of life Jesus has modeled for us in the Bible. Anyone want to read this one? This is again from the sermon. So.
Who is to have any dealings with his neighbor should keep in mind these commandments. What you wish another to do to you, do so to him. And love your neighbor as yourself.
We are not to be isolated by him. Yet we are. I mean, I felt that when I asked the question. Everyone was quiet for about 3 seconds. For those of you who relate, I asked everyone to share how much they make in a year with someone they don't know. So any quick thoughts or?
I'm thinking about where we live in Boston. When I quit my job to stay home with Amos, we quickly found that the people we got to know were people who made enough money so that one person could stay home with their child or children. And so income says so much. Unless there certainly are families who make less money, who sacrifice a lot of material things or vacations.
grocery store you choose to go to, go to your local village market or Whole Foods.
Sure.
Sure. And of course, it passes on to the next generation. If you're a single mother and you only have one income, and your neighbor is a family with two incomes, well, their kids get to go soccer, their kids get to go to ballet lessons, their kids get to go swimming in a private pool. Your kid doesn't get all those advantages. And in the next generation, they're going to be poorer because of it. And it goes on, generation by generation.
Other thoughts?
There's a whole question of independence versus interdependence. This seems to be saying be independent, and not this, but the John Locke. Do your own stuff and don't rely on other people. I think the only way out of that is to be interdependent, to need your neighbor, to need you. That's totally counter to our culture.
I have this thought that I just put out, and it is that I think it's so much easier to help people who are poor than to befriend people. And that, in great part because of class embodies education and money. So not only can you have more materially, but your ability to negotiate verbally or by way of ideas can differ radically.
And that links to Eva's question slash comment earlier about, are you supposed to take profit and then skim off what you need to get by and then donate the rest? Or do you limit yourself at the level of the profit that you pay? Do you not tip any more than you need, lower your prices? Or do you maximize your take and then act in charitable ways to sort of offset the take?
That's a good question. And I'm not the most practical person. So one of the things I've also wanted to do in this session is think about practical ways we could think about income and entitlement. And I came across this idea, and I called it cultivate empathy. And there are families who do this, that they make a certain amount, but they certainly make above the poverty line. And what they do is they try to live based on the poverty level for the size of their family for a week, once a month, or a whole month, once a year, and they tithe the rest. As a means to really say, there are people, frankly, I mean, there are people in Northfield, Minnesota who live this, no doubt. In fact, Northfield, Minnesota is a very segregated community. I can tell you where all the Mexicans live. They live in a trailer park down by the river and the train tracks called Viking Terrace. They're mostly migrant. They come from, most of them come from the same region in Mexico. They don't mix. They go to the Catholic Church. They sort of have their own service at the Catholic Church in Spanish. I think my Lutheran Church isn't really sure what to do with them in some ways. So I'm wondering, what does this make you think about? Is this something worth cultivating?
Even if I live off of $11,000 a year, I'm not going to know what that means because I would have a safety net to go back to, and I have a master's degree, and I, have health insurance, and so it's not to say that it's not worth doing, but I think there's just always a risk of feeling sort of self-important.
Sure. I did the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, and it's, I know there's a maybe not this room, but my sister-in-law did it, and Chris Sharon did it. So Scott actually did it the year before. It's many of those same kind of conversations about this. In some ways, we're pretending. You know, we can still go home for Christmas and eat a big dinner and get lots of gifts because we know we don't have to live in this context. So.
But do you do this to figure out what it means to be poor, or do you do it to figure out how you're spending your money, and do you have other choices with your money? Because every time I take more than I need, what I understand is that it can create havoc, collectively creates havoc on the rest of the world. So if I could understand how to live lower than I am on the food chain or on the stuff chain, then could I find other things to do with that money?
I guess it's sort of along Pam's line. I see two values to this. One could be political. I think there's been some good efforts efforts of people living on food stamps for a week, you know, getting congresspeople to try that and do that as a challenge, sort of raise an issue of the inadequacy, actually, of our food stamp levels and how they haven't changed. So it can be part of a political strategy. But I think it could also be part of a... I haven't tried this, but could it be part of a doing this? Could that awaken a new insight that would challenge me to use the influence that I do have differently? So I think at it's sort of what comes out of the empathy. And that's going to be different for different people. I don't know that I'm not saying there's one answer to that, but that might empower one to then go from there.
Sure.
Sort of the Thomas Merck moving back and forth between contemplation and social action.
Sure.
It seems like as a Christian family, this is like fasting.
Actually trying to imagine how I would even do this, because if I did it for a week every month, well, so do I pay my rent? What do I do? Okay, so I don't drive a car for a week. Okay, I can get that, but what about the electric bill? How do I even think about the mechanics of sort of for a week pretending?
Mm-hmm. Well, to me it raises so many other questions about the lifestyle choices that we've made to get where we are. I mean, my wife and I just bought a house, and it's actually, we downsized, though it's a house we've been renting for a while, and didn't really mean we had to get rid of anything, but we ended up really saying, okay, this is a huge purchase, and is this something that our money should really go towards? No. We're fine in an apartment. It's not great. We don't love it, but frankly, when the roof breaks, we don't have to worry about it. But at the same time, we sort of felt, it is an interesting time to sort of think about our choices and know that when we buy houses as Americans, I mean, for those of you who are a lot older than I am, I mean, I imagine when I would describe the average house in 1950. The average house in 1950 and the average house today, I'm sure it's ballooned massively. And when you have a house, what do?
You fill it.
You fill it. Or you go to Menards every other minute because you forgot the wrong screw or you bought the wrong drill. You got the wrong paint. And I think we sort of live in a culture that says bigger is better. New is better, new and improved. I mean, those kinds of attitudes. And it's about housing. And our income sort of partially drives that, I think, too. You know, living like everyone else lives and seeing the suburbs and Alta.
It would be interesting if, rather than trying it individually and feeling like
Yeah, or once a week have a shared meal at the church. You know, Holden has the hunger awareness meal, the lunch. I'm actually, probably not all of you know that, but is it Thursday afternoons? Yeah. You get a potato or rice, and the money that they save from that meal goes towards an organization or some type of nonprofit institution that works on hunger. So, but any other quick questions about or thoughts about this practice?
I guess what I feel like that practice is missing is the discrepancy in wealth among classes, because families or individuals can have the same income, but to have wealth in your background
makes
all the difference. And that's
where
you get the education and where you get the insurance. And and that's, I have read, is one of the biggest reasons why people of color are so much poorer.
Absolutely.
And have such a difficult time improving their their place in this country in our economic system, because they don't have the wealth, because they were deprived. Because for African Americans, for example, after the Civil War, they didn't get the 40 acres and the mule, and they don't have the family wealth, and they haven't been able to accumulate that.
Even more than that, it's actually housing policies.
Right,
that
too, yeah.
From the 20s on, the federal government subsidized white middle-class families to buy a house. And I think 2008 was sort of a reckoning for wealth for a lot of people, which is why the economic turmoil has happened, because so much wealth is tied up in your houses. And starting in the 20s, blacks couldn't get loans.
Well,
and if
GI
you don't have, you can't have a house.
Yeah, yeah. The GI Bill.
I went to college because partially my parents got home equity loans based on their house.
So I'm disturbed by something at a younger level. How is it that we decide that our children need soccer and dance lessons and all those things that are good and wonderful? Because that puts them at a socially at different level than kids who don't have that. So is there a decision to be made somehow about shared experience at age levels? It's a hard one, because it makes a huge difference for where people end up.
So there again, then, is the decision by family, or is it by communities? So we want to make sure that every child in this school gets the opportunity, whether they have the money or not.
Well, that's what public education.
Well, yeah.
But
yeah.
The opportunity, I'll use Jacob as an example, the opportunity just to travel has set him way above some of his peers in class, because he's been to Washington, D.C., he's been to Boston, he's been to these other places that other kids never go to, and when he takes a test, bang, the answer's right there, it's in front of him. He doesn't have to draw on book knowledge, he's lived it, he's been there. It's an opportunity that, you know, a lot of kids don't get. How do you get it then? How do you get kids to hold it?
Yeah. Well, in some ways, how do you define, how do we see a robust need for a commons?
Mm-hmm.
Commons meaning education, healthcare, access to jobs, I mean, those kinds of things. I will point out it's after 7:15. So you're welcome to talk a little bit more or bother me after Gus or anything like that.
So I have a radical thought to speak to that, because I work in public education my whole career. And one of the biggest differences between the schools is not in the funding that they get from the central office, but it's in the money from PTA.
Yeah.
No property tax.
So if you really want to level the playing field, what you do is you go back to your neighborhood school district and you say, we should pool all of the PTA contributions as a district and then redistribute them, so that you're not giving to your school, you're giving to all of the kids in the entire district, and that is centralized and then spread back out, so that every school gets the same playground equipment, every school gets the same bonuses for their teachers. Because my neighborhood school, where my son went, during Teacher Appreciation Week, it was insane what the PTA was throwing at teachers in terms of gifts.
It's a deep shift in conceptual theory. Thank you.
Thank you.
No.